This is Rank and File Radio on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. Rank and File Radio is a weekly program covering labor issues from national and international perspectives. We are your hosts, Andrew Stevens
and Cameron Willis. Today we conclude our interview with David Camfield, a professor of labor studies at the University of Manitoba and author of Canadian Labor in Crisis, Reinventing the Workers' Movement.
But first, here's this week's labor news update.
Saturday, April 28th, marks the annual Workers' Memorial Day, an international day of remembrance and action for workers killed, disabled, or injured on the job. Each year, more than 2 million women and men die as a result of work-related accidents and diseases worldwide. Workers' Memorial Day was started by the Canadian Union of Public Employees, CUPE, in 1984, with the Canadian Labour Congress declaring an annual day of remembrance in 1985. In 1991, an Act of Parliament recognized a national day of mourning for persons killed or injured in the workplace. April 28th was selected because it marks the day in 1914 when the Workers' Compensation Act was passed. April 28th is recognized by the International Labour Organization and International Trade Union Confederation as International Workers' Memorial Day.
The 2012 Labour Notes Conference is fast approaching. Labour Notes conferences are the biggest gatherings of grassroots union activists and worker center leaders in the United States and Canada. This year, the conference is being held in Chicago, May 4th to 6th. Labour Notes is a media and organizing project that began in 1979 as a voice for rank-and-file union activists, local union leaders, and labor activists who aim to provoke change in the U.S. labor movement. Find out more about the conference at www.labornotes.org.
The longest student strike in Quebec history continues to gain momentum. Over 170,000 students have been on strike for over 2 months. The March 22nd Manifestation Nationale witnessed over 300,000 students joining the demonstrations in what was an unlimited and well-coordinated general strike. The movement remains strong in the face of the Charest government's refusal to negotiate with student groups and the university CEGEP administration efforts to use injunctions and threats to force students back to school. On the streets, students have been met with police violence in what has become a coordinated effort by the government to crush the strike. The student strike began as a response to the Liberal government's promise to raise tuition fees by 75% over the next 5 years. While the media in English Canada has focused mostly on the fact that students in Quebec pay some of the lowest tuition fees in the country, these reports ignore the long history of activism and student mobilization that has helped to secure an accessible and high-quality post-secondary education system in Quebec. Some commentators suggest that the government's decision to raise tuition is about more than controlling expenses and countering the underfunding of post-secondary education in Quebec. Here's what Eric Martin, a professor at Édouard Montpetit College and researcher with the Institut de Recherche et d'Information Socio-Économique, had to say about tuition fees and post-secondary education in Quebec.
There has been a lot of talk about the university in Quebec being underfinanced, but that's far from the truth, I think, that if you look at the numbers, universities never had so much money as they have now. They get lots of money, especially research money, which has doubled in the last 10 years, $21.2 billion going into research. The problem is that the money that they're getting is money that is, has restrictions to it and strings attached. You can't use it for teachers paying teaching or paying the general function of the university. You have to use the money for mainly corporate-oriented research. So I think that we don't have a problem of lack of funds. The problem that we have is that the funding is badly allocated, and according to criteria, which is more and more dictated by governments or corporations, which have their views on what universities should do in society. We used to think that university was something that is supposed to transmit culture and develop the judgment of people, but now more and more people in the elite, in the economic elite, see it as only a tool for increasing the growth of economy and capital. And of course, this means that more and more resources are dedicated to the research, which is taking more and more place. And at the same time, teaching, which used to be the core mission of the institution, is lacking funding. So there's not so much a problem of lack of funding as a problem of misallocation of the funds. As for alternatives, it would be fairly easy in Quebec not only to renounce the tuition hike, but to instate free tuition. And we could do this for about $700 million. And many people would think, oh, it's a lot of money, but not really, actually. If you look at the tax cuts that have been given to the wealthy families in the past 10 years, they amount to about $10 billion a year. Or if you look at the capital tax that was eliminated from corporations' fiscal taxation, we have deprived ourselves as a society of $2.4 billion a year in funding that we could have used not only to make free tuition, but at least like three times the tuition, because $2.4 billion, so we can abolish tuition and use the rest of the money to invest in social services. So basically, this is to show that the money exists. The problem is mainly in the priorities and orientations that we are giving to university under the influence of a neoliberal doctrine which says that university should not be a place of learning, but should be an auxiliary to the corporations to help them make more money.
On Saturday, April 21st, over 15,000 demonstrators rallied outside of Queen's Park as part of the Day of Action organized by the Ontario Federation of Labour. Many citizens were bussed in from across the province to participate in the event. Workers, trade unionists, and community activists were there to protest the Liberal government's austerity budget and its assault on public services. The day before, representatives from 90 community and labor groups unveiled a province-wide campaign called We Are Ontario to challenge budgets that prioritize the interests of corporations over that of average Ontario citizens. As Ontario Federation of Labor President Sid Ryan stated in a press release, quote, "By putting the interests of bankers ahead of Ontario families, Premier McGuinty has awakened a deep and diverse opposition that reflects every community in the province." That afternoon, Premier Dalton McGuinty agreed to several Ontario NDP demands to secure passage of the government's budget and to avoid the possibility of another provincial election. McGuinty announced $90 million in additional funding for childcare operators and a 1% increase in Ontario Disability Support Program payments. The Premier was silent on the third concession, the 2% surtax on individuals who earn more than $500,000 a year. The tax measure is estimated to raise additional revenues of $570 million. To speak more about the Day of Action, we are joined by Matt Schultz, the Vice President Campaigns and Community Affairs with the Society of Graduate and Professional Students at Queen's University. Matt participated in the April 21st demonstration. Matt, thanks for joining Rank and File Radio.
Oh, no problem.
So tell us what happened at the Day of Action on April 21st in Toronto.
Well, 96 buses came in from across Ontario, bringing in about 15,000 people to Queen's Park. There was a very large rally there where 18 speakers gave very short speeches, including Andrea Horwath, a number of labor union representatives, and Occupy Toronto actually closed it off. Following that, we went on a march sort of around the Queen's Park area, down around Bay Street. And that was pretty much it.
So tell us, why did you attend the Day of Action?
I attended for a number of reasons. First, as a member of PSAC 901, Local 901, the TA's union. Second, in my capacity as Vice President Campaigns Community Affairs. Third, as a concerned citizen and concerned graduate student.
So what was the mood and the energy like at the demonstration?
It was pretty tame, actually, about what you would expect. People were obviously very angry, but also fairly calm and, very respectful. You know, it was very non-confrontational. There was not a heavy security presence at all.
If you were to characterize the crowd in attendance, how would you paint a picture for our audience if you were to look over the thousands of people that were there?
From what I saw, it was, well, I mean, this is primarily a labor union rally, right? So it was, median age was, you know, middle-aged, 40s, 50s. There was, you know, the Air Canada Union, teachers' unions, you know, PSAC, obviously, various other public sector unions. So it was, you know, middle-aged people for the most part. A few younger people, the Toronto Young New Democrats were there, some TA's unions, people like that. But for the most part, it was a concerned citizens, but they were not angry radicals, put it that way.
PSAC 901, which represents, as you said, teaching assistants and teaching fellows at Queen's University, helped organize the bus that took folks from Kingston to Toronto. Tell us what the 901 presence was like at Queen's Park.
We really brought the noise. It was a fairly small group that went up. I think about a dozen people were on the bus, including a few people who weren't actually PSAC 901 members. But like I said, the rest of the protest was very tame, but our group was not. We were we had a megaphone with us. My predecessor at SGPS, Anne-Marie Grandin, had that, and a bunch of drums, and we were just kind of like dancing through the streets and shouting slogans, moving our fists in the air, and it was a really good time, and we got a really good response, actually, not just from the other marchers, but sort of bystanders who kind of picked up on that festive atmosphere.
From the point of view of an executive member of the SGPS, why should graduate and professional students care about the provincial budget and what people were demonstrating at the rally?
Well, this government has really thrown students under the bus with this budget. And in an incredibly disingenuous, deceptive way. They promised us over and over and over again during the last election that there was going to be a 30% reduction in tuition, and this is urgently needed, not just by undergraduates, by all students in this province. We pay the highest tuition in the country. We receive the lowest per-student funding from the government in the country, graduate with the highest student debt. So this is relief, which is really urgently required. And then when the government came in and they said, okay, well, we're not going to give everyone a 30% tuition reduction. We're going to give a 30% grant, which is means tested, to anyone who isn't a graduate student, a professional student, an international student, a mature student, and mature students especially, you know, they often have children. They need this more than anyone else probably, but it's only sort of like, you know, middle class or undergraduates who are able to access this. Meanwhile, they've given the green light to the universities to have a 5% tuition increase. So everyone else has really gotten kind of damaged by this. And at the same time, adding insult to injury, I think, in order to fund this tuition increase or this tuition grant, they've clawed back funding from a number of other programs, some of them specifically helping disadvantaged students from lower income backgrounds, and others, like research funding towards graduate students, has been clawed back. And when you run the numbers on it, as the Canadian Federation of Students has done quite a while ago, it turns out that for every dollar in additional funding going to students, $1.20 is being clawed back.
That concludes this week's Labor News Update. Stay tuned for the second half of our interview with David Camfield after these messages.
Kick off your Sunday morning with some great gospel and regular bluegrass music. Brother Brian's Bluegrass Show is on 8 to 11 a.m. every Sunday with 2 hours of gospel bluegrass, then 1 hour of regular bluegrass. Also, I have feeble attempts at humor, the latest on bluegrass news and record charts, some interviews, weather reports, and lots of community news and upcoming events. Join me, Brother Brian, every Sunday, 8 to 11 a.m. on CFRC 101.9 for new, traditional, bluegrass, and the odd old-time country song.
He didn't look at anything. He just listened.
Boy, talk about your radical ideas.
Look, dear, you're just too young to remember, I guess. I'll have someone from the audience explain it. Anybody here remember radio? Anybody? Anybody at all?
I do.
Oh, good. But here's a lady. Here's a lady. Come right up here, madam. Watch your step here.
You do remember radio programs, do you?
Oh, yes, yes, I remember them.
You used to listen to them, did you?
I did as a girl, yes, my goodness, yes.
Well, for the benefit of this young lady, could you tell us what it was like?
Well, it was, no, dear, I'm trying to remember.
Just take your time.
Well, if my memory serves me correct, we'd hurry to get the dishes done, and we'd all sit around the living room listening to the
radio.
Radio, that's it.
Watching too much television? Forgetting about radio? Refresh your memory by tuning in to 101.9 FM CFRC Queens Radio 90.9 on cable, www.cfrc.ca on the web.
Want to help make Queens a positive space? Well, you can by attending a short workshop put on by the Positive Space Program. Once enlightened, you can post a Positive Space sticker in your work, living, or study area, helping to create a campus free of discrimination. Contact the Human Rights Office or email POSSPACE@post.queensu.ca. Remember, look for the stickers with the rainbow triangle and a Q, which designates a queer positive space.
Welcome back to Rank and File Radio. Here is the second half of our interview with David Canfield.
You've already started to touch upon the question of the state. Perhaps it's impressionism, but it seems as though since the conservative government was elected last May, that there's been an uptick in the number of threats, as well as threats being carried out of back-to-work legislation, and not simply in the public sector, but also in the private sector with Air Canada. Do you see a changing role of the state in labor-capital relations in Canada at the moment, or is this more evolutionary, evolving out of something that's been going on long-term?
I would say it's the latter. It's more, I don't think it's a dramatic break. What is different is that since the Conservatives got a majority in the House of Commons, they have been definitely more aggressive in terms of using the full extent of their state authority within their jurisdiction, which is people who work for the federal government and if federally regulated industries like airlines and the post office, to intervene on the side of the employer. That's been very clear. And that it's not just an attack on those workers directly affected. It also is important in a political sense in that it sends a message to provincial governments. It really is a kind of get tougher kind of message that's being sent here. And so I think that's it's not by any means a dramatic change, because this kind of state intervention has been happening for some decades with increasing frequency. But since 2007, there was an important Supreme Court ruling which raised the bar in terms of the legal test for government, for state intervention that would interfere with collective bargaining. It did not, as some observers said, make it impossible, but it by extending some limited protection of the Charter of Rights to the freedom of association, did make it more difficult for governments to do it. It held them to a higher test. And so what's been interesting is the federal government has intervened in ways that they hope will meet the legal test, that will survive legal challenges, but still are quite aggressively intervening on the side of the employer. And so I think that does encourage provincial governments to do the same. Not that many of them needed a lot of encouragement, but it does send a general get tough message. And it's also part of an ideological battle which tries to question the legitimacy of unions and question the legitimacy of unionized workers going on strike to defend their past gains in a context of a global economic crisis. And so that's also about stigmatizing unionized workers in the eyes of other workers. So I think it's both directly intervening in particular situations that are seen as problematic by the government, but also they're doing this with an eye to having a broader impact on society.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask a question related to your book. You mentioned the necessity of unity between Quebec and the rest of Canada's workers, English Canadian primarily. Can you elaborate on your position about that unity, the unity of workers in both Quebec and the rest of Canada, and maybe talk a little bit about the tensions and what that means for the workers' movement, why it's, as you argue, a weakness for kind of either anti-Quebec feelings or any sort of anti-Quebec sentiment, why you think that is problematic for the workers' movement.
Okay. So I see, just to be brief, I see the Canadian state as a colonial settler state established on the basis of the conquest of indigenous peoples, and then the subordination of what later became Quebec to, you know, what we could call English Canada. And so it's I see the Canadian state as a multinational state, but not one where the different nations within it are existing on a level of a level playing field. You know, it's not a situation of equality. Mm-hmm. Although much has changed in the last 50 years, people of Quebec and their majority consider themselves to be a nation, but they do not have the legal right to determine their own future within the Canadian Constitution. They don't have the right to freely decide whether they would stay or leave the Federation. And so there's a fault line then that runs through Canadian society, runs through Canadian politics. You know, this is the old two solitudes thing. It's not just about language, although that's certainly part of it. And, so this is something which then when it comes to union organization, I mean, it's manifested in the fact that you have on a pan-Canadian level, one major labor federation, the Canadian Labor Congress, but within Quebec you have three major federations, only one of which is part of the Canadian Labor Congress. So you have an organizational gap there, many, many unionized workers in Quebec not being part of the same basic institutional structure as the majority of unionized workers within the state as a whole. And you have a general lack of understanding of the specific history and experiences and issues of, the Québécois mm-hmm. outside of Quebec. And people outside Quebec just tend to think of Quebec as one province. You know, within Quebec, the problem is different. If you speak to, many left-wing Québécois activists, they identify that, the problem that they end up confronting is that they end up often sort of thinking politically and acting politically within a Quebec, only a kind of a Quebec framework,
mm-hmm.
Whereas, of course, the attacks that people face are being organized on a pan-Canadian level, but we don't have much in the way of an ability to organize a pan-Canadian response. And so this is it's an ongoing challenge here, and it's possible that this could become increasingly important in the future if, we have a situation now where there are very few Tory MPs from Quebec.
Yep.
And as the Harper government prosecutes its aggressive austerity agenda, and its imperialist agenda, we could see its popularity fall still further within Quebec. It's possible, depending on how it plays out, that it could lead to a revival of the Bloc Québécois, the Parti Québécois within Quebec, particularly if the Harper government, the Harper government has an interest in actually promoting that in a strange way. On the one hand, they don't want a strong movement for Quebec independence. On the other hand, they want to undermine the NDP in Quebec. And so if they do things which, would lead more Québécois to support the BQ rather than the NDP, that would actually be in the interests of the Harper government in terms of its electoral calculations. So if they, there's a concern hot button issues that could be pressed. We've seen the Tories, have a finely honed ability to do that when they think it's will be good for them. And if that happens, so if there's any kind of revival of the national question in terms of discussion around Quebec independence or Quebec's place within Confederation, the labor movement outside Quebec is really poorly prepared to deal with it because of there hasn't really been any discussion about this since 1995 in the last referendum. It's not part of people's labor education, so people aren't really well prepared to think about the political issues that would come up and to navigate through those in a way that would build workers' unity in a way that's not unity at the lowest common denominator level, but unity on the basis of freely recognizing the right of the Québécois to determine their own future.
I guess I didn't intend to ask this, but it's you've brought up the NDP and its situation now in Quebec, and your book obviously touches upon the relationship with the NDP and the labor movement. I was wondering if you could comment on, having been through the recent leadership campaign and pro-labor candidates like Peggy Nash having a very low first vote. I was wondering if maybe you could comment on whether or not there's a changing relationship going on between organized labor, workers more generally, in the NDP. I know it's a complex question, but any comment would be great.
Okay. Well, I think there's two questions, you know, the relationship of organized labor, like the labor leadership in the NDP versus the relationship between the whole working class and the NDP. They're not the same questions exactly. But the, I think there is, it's complex because on the one hand, there's such a desire among so many people to get rid of the Tories that the pressures of lesser evilism are very strong. The kind of anybody but the Tories sentiment, right? Mm-hmm. I think is quite significant, and that leads lots of people, whether they're union officials or unionized workers or other people, to just, you know, because the Conservatives are so awful for so many reasons, to not look too critically at the NDP, and now that the NDP is the official opposition, to really put a lot of their eggs in, or all their eggs in the basket of the NDP in terms of their hopes and aspirations for how we can stop the agenda that the Harper government is prosecuting so aggressively. And so that it politically reinforces the relationship. But at the same time, the relationship is changed by the fact that the kind of institutional, formal ties between the labor officialdom, the union officialdom, and the NDP have loosened. You know, there wasn't the same structure of union vote representation in the process of selecting an NDP leader as has existed in the past, if you go back into the history of the NDP. So there's a loosening of the formal ties, because the NDP leadership, above all, I think, wants to put some distance, greater distance between itself and the unions in general, but it wants to be able to continue to draw on the important volunteer energy that so many union members do give to the NDP. So it wants to use them on the one hand, but to have even fewer ties of obligation. Mm-hmm. I think to unions on the other hand, and this is only going to increase with the election of Mulcair, who is the most Blairite, if you like, of the contenders for the NDP leadership, not someone who comes from the central traditional establishment of the party. I think would be a mistake to think that there was a real, debate involved in this. There was very little debate on policy at all. There was an enormous political consensus. I would say this is, the first time in a very long time that there wasn't any kind of left challenger from outside the party establishment to the other candidates. And so that's just something about the narrowing of political discussion within the NDP, and because it costs $15,000 to run a candidate, the left wing of the party, which is extremely weak, wasn't able to put up anybody for financial reasons. But I think that you have on the one hand this, as I said, this attempt to try to loosen the relationship coming from, especially from the NDP side of things, from the top brass of the NDP. But this is also a kind of a, maybe cementing might be too strong a word, but the bonds are still very much there in terms of people's sentiments often because of the fact that defeating the Tories through extra-parliamentary mobilization doesn't seem to be on the cards to people, and therefore voting them out, voting NDP seems to be the option that's most attractive. And all this happening at a time of falling expectations where simply having a government that didn't aggressively kick people in the teeth on a regular basis would be seen as a great step forward by lots of people. And so I think that's, those are a few thoughts on the dynamic. What I haven't really addressed, and it's another whole question, is like, what is the NDP today? What has it become? Is it the same party that it was in 1988 when under Ed Broadbent, it fought against the free trade deal with the U.S., and when it was in a certain mold. I think there have been a lot of changes since then, and that's something which left-wing analysis needs to work on.
That concludes Rank and File Radio's interview with David Camfield, professor of labor studies at the University of Manitoba and author of Canadian Labor in Crisis, Reinventing the Workers' Movement, published in 2011 by Fernwood Publishing. Join us next Wednesday, 5:30 to 6 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. Stay tuned.
Will never learn. It says here. forgotten. And it says here we should be proud that we are free. And our free press reflects our democracy. Those crying voices on the right of the house are echoed down the street and shine. Where politics mix with bingo and tips in the money and numbers game. Where they offer you a future on stockings and suspenders, which will all be stiffer penalties for sex offenders. Says here that this year's prince is born. It says here, do you ever wish that you were better informed? And it says here that we can only stop the rot with a large dose of law and order and a touch of a short, sharp shot. If this did not reflect your view, you should understand. Those who own the papers also own this land, and they'd rather you believed in Coronation Street capers in the war circulation. It sells newspapers. Could it be an infringement of the freedom of the press to print pictures of women in states of undress? That your paper is Tory, just remember, there are two sides to every story.